Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland, and joining me again is Chuck Bryant from Stuff You Should Know.
Howdy do.
Howdy do to you, Chuck. If you tuned in to our last episode, you heard the beginning of the epic tale of the rise and fall of Atari. We talked about Atari's founding up to the point where its founder, Nolan Bushnell, sells the company to Warner Communications, and now we're going to talk about where things went from that point forward.
Yeah, I should say, I almost said hello by doing my impression of the home 2600 version of Pac-Man, but I didn't do it.
I appreciate that.
I'll do that when we talk about it in 10 minutes.
Yeah, we will get there. So 1977, we were teasing it at the end of the last episode. This is when Atari releases the revolutionary, and I mean that sincerely. I am not being snarky. Revolutionary Atari Video Computer System, a.k.a. the Atari VCS, a.k.a. the Atari 2600.
Yeah, and I didn't even know, but I saw that you researched where the name 2600 came from.
Yeah, so, all right, when you're a company and you make stuff, you give units part names,
sure,
right? So like in a hardware store, you might have a typical, like a type of screw of a certain length that's a Phillips head screw. And to describe the whole thing would take you like five lines of text, because you're talking about the length, the type of screw head, how close the treads are. Or you could just give it a part name.
Yeah.
And then you say, I need 15 of HCX, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
Well, the part name for this system was the CX2600. So they just said, all right, we're just going to call it the Atari 2600.
Because it sounds, futuristic and
right.
Cool and...
Sure. Whereas the rest of us are thinking, like, where were Atari's 1 through 2599?
I always thought that.
Yeah, so this is just an identifier that makes it easy to refer to a part. Now, in this case, it just made a really compelling sounding device. And it goes on sale in the United States for $199 on the low end.
Yeah.
The high end was $229.
Sure. It shipped with two joysticks.
Yep.
I guess the $229 version came with the paddles.
I guess so. I had that. I had the paddles.
Yeah, I had the paddles too. Yeah. There's no other way to play Breakout properly without paddles.
Right.
And it came with combat.
Yeah.
It came with one game, which was really, can't remember actually how many variations there were.
Right, because they had the tanks, they had the airplanes, jets.
Well, I told you in the last episode, my brother and I were playing combat last week at his house on his 2600, and we were kind of cracking up at, here's one version where it's the two tanks. And then the next version is the same thing, but they're invisible.
Right.
And the next version is, it's the same thing, but the bullets bounce off the walls.
That was my favorite one.
Yeah, where you could bank shots into each other.
Yeah.
And the invisibility.
Or you could hit yourself.
I didn't know that.
If you bank it so that it bounces back and goes through your tank, it actually hit yourself. And that was really frustrating.
I did not know that. Yeah. And then of course they had the air combat games.
Yep.
You could be fighter pilots, or you could be biplanes, or you could be that giant, whatever that was.
Right.
And there were clouds in some versions.
Yep.
You fly behind clouds, not in other versions. So they managed to really milk combat for many, many different versions of essentially the same game.
Yeah. And as I recall, the way you would play that is there were physical switches on the Atari itself that you could manipulate and get different versions as well.
Yeah.
Or was there one that – was it like a – it wasn't a menu system, right?
It was a menu. It was a toggle on the front of the game that you just toggle through the different versions.
Which is kind of interesting. Like it was the actual console itself that had physical switches in the up or down position, and that's how you could determine which version you were playing. And,
yep.
So those days of having that video screen with the menu where it's like start, load game, save game – didn't exist.
No.
and once that game, like we mentioned in the previous episode, once you turn that console off, all that information disappears because it's only in read-only memory.
That's right. And I think any of us that got three-quarters of the way through Raiders of the Lost Ark and someone accidentally flicked the reset switch.
Oh.
Bad things.
Yeah. Oh, man. And that game was one of the most complicated Atari games that I can recall. And
we were talking about it.
Yeah,
we'll save that.
We'll save it. We'll talk on our reflections of some of our favorite games later on. But technically, the system was ready for shipping a year before it came out, but Atari sat on it. And the reason they sat on it was because of something we mentioned in the last episode, that big agreement they had with Magnavox.
Yeah.
Part of that agreement was they would give Magnavox the rights to anything Atari produced within that year. And so they thought, well, if we wait a little longer,
save us a lot of money.
We won't give them the rights to the Atari 2600. We'll retain them ourselves. So they sat on it and released it a year late. And originally, they were only going to create 10 titles for this thing. They thought that the market for it would be something that would last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And they would just produce it for that before moving on to something else. And therefore, you would have more flexibility.
Yeah.
Because you could switch out titles. But they thought, well, there's no real market here. We're not going to go beyond that. But some of the programmers started playing around with it and said, wait a minute. We have the opportunity here to make stuff that has never been in the arcades.
Yeah.
That could be totally new, groundbreaking. There's a lot more potential with this hardware.
Yeah, like here's where the money is,
yeah,
fellas. How about 200 titles,
right,
that you can sell for $30 a piece?
Yeah, and so they said, this sounds like a good idea.
Well, yeah, but Atari was not – the 2600 was not a smash hit right out of the gate.
No, it actually –
first couple of years were sort of lackluster because
people
didn't really get that it was more than Pong.
Right.
At first.
And Warner Communications didn't really market it well either. So there was some downfalls in the marketing
side. They weren't
a
video game company. They didn't really know what to do with it.
And it was expensive. I mean, $199, that doesn't sound like it's that expensive today. But keep in mind, we're talking 1970s money. You know, that's like more than $700.
Yeah.
For this thing that, at least at first, was only going to play 10 titles. That's not a big selling point. For someone who's, I'm gonna shell out the better part of a grand to get a machine that can play 10 games.
Yeah, I remember my brother and I, how you would submit the Christmas list to the parents.
Yes.
Here's what Scott wants. Here's what Chuck wants. We had to share, we had to both go in, all in on Atari. This Christmas, both of us want together is this one $200 item. And my parents were like, all right, well, you better play it.
It's funny because I actually got my Atari fairly close to the not too long before the great video game crash, which we will get to, which meant that the price had actually come down because there was a lot of competition in that space.
I got it pretty early on.
Yeah, I
wish I could remember what year, but I don't think it was 78, but I bet it was 80.
Yeah, I was probably closer to 81, 82 for me. So in 1978, that's when Nolan Bushnell leaves Atari.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit in the last episode about the corporate structure at Warner's and how it just did not jibe at all with these creative sort of pot-smoking hippie game designers.
Yeah.
And he just got more and more upset and discontented and or discontent. Discontent.
He felt discontentment. Patient.
To where he basically tried to get himself fired and
succeeded.
Did. Yeah.
He had a huge fight with a Warner executive in front of the board of directors.
Yeah.
And that was that. He was told to pack his things and go. So he leaves.
It was a big bummer after that. I mean, it was already sort of a bummer, but him leaving was a very symbolic deal for Atari's. Sort of the downfall of Atari.
Yeah, some people refer to the sale of Atari to Warner as the first quote-unquote death of Atari.
Yeah.
Some people refer to Nolan's departure as the first death, but at any rate...
They're kind of tied, I think.
It was, it's a big change. I mean, they did happen fairly close to one another in time.
Yeah, he didn't last long there.
There was the new CEO of Atari is Ray Kassar.
Yeah, he was not well liked by the developers.
No, in fact,
to say the least,
his name would be used for a famous Atari title later.
That's
on.
That's right. What was it?
Yar's Revenge.
That's right.
It was just Ray backwards.
It's pretty good.
Yar's Revenge, and then apparently, Kassar said, "That's clever."
Like, oh, really?
So it must have been a whew moment for the.
Right.
At any rate, Al Cornyn, Harry Jenkins, and Roger Hechter at this time begin to work on a handheld electronic game system that used holography as its display. So a holographic display, and it was called the Cosmos.
I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, it was a handheld thing. It was supposed to have 9 games with all the game information actually on the device itself, but you would switch cartridges out because the cartridges had the information for the holographic display.
Yeah, I had a Merlin. Do you remember that?
I do remember the Merlin.
The little red, it looked like a telephone.
Yeah.
And then I can't remember the name of it. Again, if someone knows this, I know you'll write in. It was a really great handheld that had a dial on the bottom, and it was about 9 inches tall and about 3 inches wide, and it had a screen, mm-hmm. and it had cartridges you load. It had, like, Breakout.
Huh.
I can't remember the name of it, but it was really advanced for the time.
Yeah, I did a Tech Stuff episode, a series of them, actually, about a lot of the consoles and handheld consoles that came out during this time, which was fairly extensive but not exhaustive. We didn't. You can't cover everything. There was just
no,
too much.
No, there's a lot of no-name ones that just sort of came and went.
Yeah, ones that, or they had like, a very limited release in South America.
Right.
And there are like 3 people in the United States who have one, that kind of thing.
The Guaro.
Yeah. I can't remember. I think I want to say that they were both named after cats. And one of our listeners drew me as one of the 2 cat, characters using this, and
nice.
Lauren was the other one.
Awesome.
So I've got that picture somewhere. 1979, one of the great arcade games of all time comes out from Atari, Asteroids.
Yeah, that's right.
That's, fantastic game, addictive gameplay.
A one that still holds up.
Yeah.
It's very challenging still. Once you start flying that spaceship around,
right?
It was tough to manage.
Well, because it actually used inertia and momentum, right?
Yeah.
You had to actually turn your ship and thrust in the opposite direction to stop yourself.
You had to plan ahead.
Yeah.
The asteroids, when you shoot them, would break apart into different directions.
Yep.
And if you were flying around, and if you got going too fast, and those asteroids, you start shooting them, you broke apart into little sticks very quickly.
You had to have that little teleport button that you could use like once a game. And
yeah, but that would often drop you right in the path of a big asteroid.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily a way to save yourself.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is also when Atari would release a game for the home game market that Chuck, I think you have a few things to say about. It's a little game called Adventure.
Oh, sure. Let's talk about my favorite thing ever.
Yes, please do. Let's do that.
Yes, Adventure was created by Warren Robinette.
Yep.
And I played it yesterday online.
Yeah.
Had a great time.
Still holds up.
Well.
Maybe it's nostalgia playing a little part of that.
Nostalgia's definitely playing a role. It does hold up in a way though, but it when you look at it now, and, if you're younger, you will scoff at the square that represents the knight and the arrow that represents the sword and the ducks that represent the dragons. But at the time it was, there was nothing like it out there. It was the first game that put you, it was the first person adventure game.
Yeah. It's considered the first action adventure game ever. It spawned a genre of games.
Yeah. But I don't think we can get across, like, when we were kids playing this game, we didn't see a square and an arrow.
Right.
We had imagination to go along with it.
Yeah.
And it sounds corny, but you really did, in your mind's eye, see the dragon, the red dragon coming at you, and you felt like you were the knight, and you had this great big sword. So it really played on kids' imagination, which, I mean, I love the games now, get me wrong. I'm not saying you should go back and do things like this anymore.
Although there are some games that have come out recently that have more of this old school feel to it. And they're phenomenal.
Oh, like what?
Yeah. For example, if you want a game that looks like it was made back in the early, this would be more like in the early computer game era.
Yeah.
Papers, Please. Now, let me tell you what Papers, Please is, and you're not going to believe that this is a game. In Papers, Please, you play the part of a border patrol agent who reviews documentation of people passing from one Soviet-style nation to a different Soviet-style nation.
But it's good?
It's fantastic.
Wow.
And it's done in this style. Now, like I said, it's more of a computer game style than a video game, like the home video game system.
So it's like
style.
A retro thing?
Very retro, but the gameplay is phenomenal. The style is perfect. The oppressive Soviet music and game, the writing in the game is fine. So we're seeing some people who are kind of going back to it, maybe a little later in the development cycle than adventure, but they're going back to those basics of gameplay is really important, and imagination can make up for a lot of what other people would see as like a drawback. You know, this idea that the graphics are not realistic or you know, they're very abstract.
Yeah.
These days, I'm seeing more developers say, that's not a problem.
Right.
You know, that's something we can embrace if the game is good.
Yeah, exactly. And adventure was that. I mean, there are three big things that adventure brought to the table.
Yeah.
There was a large space for the first time.
Right.
I think 30 rooms and 8 regions.
Yeah, you move from screen to screen and it would take you into a new region with new things that you had to maneuver around.
You could pick up objects and drop them and move them around and use them and manipulate them. That was a new thing.
One at a time, as I recall.
Well, which turned out to be brilliant because Raiders of the Lost Ark made things very convoluted.
Right, yeah. It meant that you didn't have to have an inventory screen. All the action could take place within that game. Like, you had to plan out what you needed. Like, are you going to need the sword on that next screen? If you don't, do you want to move the whole point of the game was getting the chalice.
Yeah. To the gold castle.
Exactly. So you might not need your sword. So dropping the sword and moving the chalice further along might be the best thing to do. But there was also another element that could really mess with you.
Bat.
Yes. The bat.
Yeah. There was a bat that would fly around and there were several levels of difficulty.
Right.
3, I think.
Yeah.
And I think the bat came in on number 2.
I think you're right.
But either on level 2 or 3, the bat would just fly around and you would be so close to getting what you needed. And it took work. This game took time. There was no timer, which was another genius move. And it would take a lot of figuring out to find your way through these mazes and catacombs.
Right.
And sometimes you would have to use this bridge to get through a wall. And it was really pretty genius.
And then the bat would come and steal the thing
the
you
bat
wanted.
Would come and steal the thing you wanted.
Or occasionally it would fly away with like a dragon, which was funny.
Yeah. And then basically then you had to go on a quest to find this bat.
Yeah.
Because the bat had the key to the Black Castle.
Right.
And the Black Castle had, you know, the chalice.
Exactly. So it was levels of complexity. Also, another really cool thing about Adventure, it's the first video game that I know of to have an Easter egg in it.
Yeah, it is the first game. I'm reading Ready Player One right now.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Great.
They talk a little bit about that.
There's actually a game inside Ready Player One.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was this game within the book itself that if you figured it out, you could win a prize. I can't remember
no
the
way.
Details. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It's actually one of those things where they released the information that there was stuff hidden in the book that if you figured it out would lead you down a pathway where you could win a prize at the end.
That's pretty cool.
It was a neat idea.
Well,
it's a good book anyway. So.
Yeah, the Easter Egg and Adventure, though, at the time, and we'll talk about this in a minute with developers not getting credit.
Yeah.
They didn't get credit at the time. And
right.
So he hid his name, basically. There was this little invisible dot that you could only find in certain rooms hidden away. And you could pick up this dot and bring it to a certain place, and it would basically take you. It would show his name on the screen, as the creator of the game, and it was the very, very first Easter egg. Pretty neat story.
Really cool. Really cool.
I could talk about Adventure for the next hour.
So we'll have to move on.
But we need to go back in time to Space Invaders.
An instrumentally important video game. One of the most popular arcade games to ever come out. In fact, Asteroids, in a way, was Atari saying, how can we capitalize on that same kind of level of obsession?
And it was a Taito?
Taito, yeah.
Taito game in the arcade. And I think the last we left off with the home 2600 unit was, it wasn't selling super well.
Right.
And everything changed when they brought licensed. And it was the first licensed game when they licensed Space Invaders. It was a huge hit.
Yeah. And also, it was a very faithful port of the game. Like, it was a good representation of what the arcade game was. You know, it wasn't as if you look at a Space Invader game, you're not going to think of it as being slick or sophisticated, but the Atari version was, you know, a little slower, a little blockier.
Yeah,
but
it was a pretty good version though.
Yeah, it was very, the gameplay was there.
Yeah.
The important elements were there. And so while it might not have been, quite the same experience as the arcade, it was a good representation of it. So it was a great move on Atari's part. Very savvy. And ended up really turning things around, started helping with the push to market this. And also, we should point out, another interesting thing was, in the early days, Atari's strategy was really to just market around the holidays.
Yeah.
This was like a Christmas item, because it was such an expensive thing. They thought, well, this is big ticket.
Right.
This is when people are going to be buying something for their kids
for
Christmas.
It really was. That was when I got my cartridges. I didn't, like, buy one in June.
Yeah, it would only be later on when they said, why don't we promote this all year round?
Yeah.
And that started to really boost the sales too. Also around this time, they were debuting home computer systems, the Atari 400 and the Atari 800.
Yeah.
Now these were both 8-bit home computers, so, you know, keep in
adorable.
Mind. They were based around that same microprocessor technology that the Atari 2600 used, although the version that the 2600 used was technically the 6507, which had fewer pins than the 6502 microprocessor. They could only address, or the VCS rather, the 2600 could only address 8 kilobytes of memory. So we're talking really, really simple stuff here.
Yeah.
Now between the 400 and the 800, you might wonder, what's the difference? Is the 800 twice as good? Is it twice as powerful? No.
Twice as expensive?
Maybe a little more expensive. Yeah, but these were two of the units that had code names that were named after women in the office.
Right.
We mentioned that previously. So the 400 was marketed more as a gaming console.
Okay.
And the 800 was marketed more as a home computer.
Gotcha.
So the 400 had essentially the same stuff as the 800, but a lot of it was inaccessible to the user. So
right.
For example, your memory slots are closed off in the 400. So what you buy out of the box is what you get. Whereas the 800 had things where you could swap stuff out.
Yeah, I remember seeing that.
Yeah.
But only to a certain degree. It had like 5 available slots.
Yeah, it wasn't like you could just continuously upgrade this. Obviously, the hardware itself had a limitation too.
Right.
But it did mean that you could customize the 800 more than you could the 400.
Which was, big deal at the time.
Yeah. So 79 is a big year for them. They make $20 million in 1979.
Yeah, the 2600 unit started basically, you know, they sold 300,000, then 500, then a million, then 2 million. And they basically started doubling every year upon year until in 1982, they hit 10 million in units sold.
Yeah.
And for Warners, they made up 70%. Of their income.
70% of a company that also oversees music and movies.
Yeah, that's just crazy.
Yeah. The rest of their business was only 30% of their revenue. I mean, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around that. We talk about the video game industry being big today.
Yeah.
It was enormous back then, relatively speaking. I mean, the pie size is different, obviously.
Right.
But the portion of the pie was huge.
Yeah, unbelievable. 70%. And, it was that time that the CEO, Kassar, started to do some really dumb things.
Yeah.
With the company, namely, hey, let's lay off some of these developers. Let's shut down the R&D department.
Right.
And let's sink all our money into marketing this
right.
stuff.
And this was bad timing because, just before he started messing around with the internal structure of the company, there were already defections from Atari, right? You had four engineers from Atari who left the company, and they formed their own company to create games.
Want me to name them?
Sure, please do.
David Crane, Bob Whitehead, Alan Miller, and Larry Kaplan.
And they formed...
David Crane built Pitfall, by the way.
One of the best games for the Atari.
But they formed, you say it.
Activision.
Yeah,
huge. Huge. So there were two big reasons why they left. One is just that the developers weren't getting a share in the profits made from the games.
Yeah, no money.
They were being paid on a make this game basis, but if a game was selling really well, they didn't get royalties.
No, and they started to see these sales. They're like, I make 20 grand a year.
Yeah, I'm the guy that made the thing.
That invented it.
That you're selling, and I'm not getting any of the proceeds there.
Yeah, sort of in a vacuum. Like they were, from what I read, sort of singular creators. It wasn't a team of people.
Yeah.
It was like a dude coming up with an idea and then seeing it through.
Pretty much every game in these days, you're talking about one person or maybe two people working on a game. But more often than not, it was a single person per game. The other reason was the one that you had mentioned earlier. They weren't getting any credit for it. So nothing. They weren't getting paid, and their names weren't appearing on the packaging. It wasn't appearing in the game. And they just wanted to have these two elements, things they thought that they were owed.
Sure.
And so they went off and formed Activision with that, and they decided they were going to continue to make games for the Atari, but they obviously wouldn't be Atari games. Like, they'd be Activision games for the Atari 2600. And this caused some friction. Atari resisted this. Atari did not want other companies making games for its console.
Well, Kassar was really PO'd about the defection to begin with.
Yeah.
I saw an interview with Crane where he said that he, at one point, when they were, at first they went to ask, like, hey, maybe we should get some of this revenue.
Yeah.
Maybe we can get credit as developers. And he said, you guys aren't any more important than the guy on the assembly line putting these things together.
Right.
And they were like, screw you, buddy.
Yeah, like, guess what? Have fun having that guy on the assembly line putting together empty cartridges. So, yeah, they all leave. Some of the games they create sell better than first-party Atari games, Pitfall being a great example of that.
Oh, yeah.
And Atari would sue Activision, trying to prevent them from producing Atari 2600 games, but all of that, by 1982, all of that had been decided. Third-party games would be completely allowed.
Sure.
And that was both a good thing and a bad thing for the video game industry. It was a good thing because companies like Activision were making some really good games.
Uh-huh.
It was a bad thing because anybody else could make whatever crap they wanted to.
Oh, man. There were some bad, bad, bad games out
there. Yeah. We'll get to them.
Dozens of them.
One of my favorite games, arcade games, was released in 1980. Two of them, actually. One of them was Missile Command.
Loved it.
Which, brilliant. Also, one of the things I love about Missile Command is when Atari went to the developers to make Missile Command, they had one demand.
Uh-huh.
They said, this game can only be a defensive game.
That's right, because it was about, essentially, the Cold War. And and nuclear war.
Yeah.
And they said, we don't want to have this be a game where you're dropping nukes on people.
No, it can be about we're shooting down missiles to stave off a nuclear attack.
Yep.
But we're not going to have anything in the game where we launch a counterattack.
Yeah.
Which was kind of cool.
Missile Command to me still holds up because the 2600 version was really good.
Yep.
It moved it from a trackball in the arcade to the joystick.
Yep.
But it didn't matter.
No, it still worked really well.
And as anyone who played Missile Command knows, as you progress through those screens, it gets really, really hard.
Yeah.
Because stuff starts coming down pretty fast.
So the other big game that came out in 1980, the one that I also loved in the arcades, Battlezone.
Oh, man. Mind-blowing.
The dual joystick controllers to control the movement of a tank.
Yep.
And, you know, push both controllers forward to go forward, pull one back to start turning in that direction.
It's a 3D... what do you call that?
Vector graphics.
Oh, yeah, 3D vector graphics.
Yeah, so what they would do is for vector graphics, you plot two points, and it draws a line between those two points.
Okay.
And then you draw another point, it draws a line between those, and that's how you could create basic shapes. And they'd be, you know, kind of this wireframe look that you would, you know, that was famous for Battlezone, and also my favorite Atari arcade game of all time, which comes out in 1983, so I'm going
to
save it. But Battlezone,
you're talking about.
It also had a scope view for some versions of the game. Not all of them had the scope view. Some of them were just the basic monitor, and then you had the controls.
Oh, see, I only played the scope view.
So did I.
Yeah.
Because that you had to put your face up to like a binoculars type thing, man.
That's
and
awesome.
You're like,
you felt like you're in a
so
tank.
Good. And it cuts away all other distractions, right? You don't
it was so
see
immersive.
Anything. Oh. Yeah, and this is a good lesson, too. We talk about immersion in things like virtual reality and talk about how people say over and over, graphics matters, but it doesn't matter as much as you think it does.
Right.
That you can feel immersed in something that has very simple graphics if it's a convincing experience.
These were green lines.
Yep.
And it was totally immersive.
Yeah.
Great, great game.
Loved that game. Always very disruptive if someone would tap on your shoulder while you were in that game. You're like, what's going on? How'd you get in my tank?
I never noticed.
So in 1981, they would come out with another phenomenal arcade game, one of the best in the world. I know I keep saying that, but it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Tempest.
Yeah, that was my favorite game, bar none. Well, that and Galaga. But
those are both great games.
Yeah, and Tempest was just, it didn't look like any other game. that had come out before it. The gameplay was different.
Full color vector graphics, so it wasn't just green or white lines. You actually had other colors. Yeah.
And it had a feature, too, I remember, where you could, at the very beginning of the game, you could skip forward. Because when you completed different levels in Tempest, you would get a certain amount of bonus points.
Yeah.
But you could opt to start later in the game and higher up on a higher level. And immediately, if you finished that one, you had immediately like 50,000 points.
Yeah, because you were
jumping ahead.
Jumping to a level that mere mortals such as myself could not hope to complete.
Yeah, it was tough though, man. It's still tough. You get spiked, buddy.
Well, yeah, because I mean, you know, you're doing like, that's task management right there.
Yeah.
You know, figuring out, okay, well, this is the one that moves around in a circle as it climbs up, so I got to keep an eye on that one. But this other one is one that shimmies up super fast, so I got to get that one first, that kind of stuff.
And you can only fire in bursts. I remember it wasn't like a continuous fire game.
Yeah. And, man, you would just see people just spinning that disc like crazy to get the Tempest to, you know, the ship to go around to the right part of the board in order to shoot the enemies.
Yeah, or when you warp to the next... When you warp to the next one, I remember that was where you had to avoid the spikes.
Yeah.
To the next level.
Yeah.
And sometimes that was just luck of the draw.
The other big game that came out in 1981 in the arcades, Centipede.
Yeah, Centipede was huge because it appealed to women and girls. Mm-hmm. And it was very colorful, very fun. It had a great gameplay with the rollerball.
Yep.
Really maximized that. And I think it was the first game actually written and developed by a woman.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That's cool. That's super cool. Well, 1981 was also when Atari would show off the Cosmos. That was that handheld game that used holography that we talked about previously. They showed it at the New York Toy Fair. They ended up accepting 8,000 pre-orders, but by the end of 1981, Atari would reverse its decision to release the game console. The project is canceled. So we never get to see what the Cosmos actually looks like.
That's a bummer.
Yeah, I'm very curious how this holographic type stuff was supposed to work. From what I understand, like the description I read was that you would only get two different images and it wasn't important for gameplay. And I thought, well, what is important for gameplay? Like maybe there's like a permanent type screen and whatever you're looking at is interacting with the quote unquote holographic image. Which would be kind of like some of the overlays that existed for other game systems where you would have to put an overlay either on the controller or sometimes on your TV.
So weird.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. 1982, Atari would launch Dig Dug in the arcades.
Love Dig Dug. Big fan.
Yep. And it also distributed one of Namco's games, a very popular game, Pole Position.
Yeah. So Atari is basically kicking butt on two levels here. They're owning... well, they're sharing ownership in the arcade along with the big boys.
Yep.
And they're, kind of owning the home system at this point.
Yeah.
They have, you know, some competition with ColecoVision.
Yep.
And Intellivision. Mm-hmm. Which were both, I think more advanced with the controls and some of the graphics.
Right.
But Atari had such a stranglehold on people at that point.
Yeah.
It was tough to kind of put a chink in their armor.
I mean, they defined the market,
yeah.
right? Intellivision was interesting because it was, this was one that had overlays, like I was talking about. So not necessarily for the screen, but for your controller. The controller,
I remember those.
It looked kind of like a remote control with a little joystick at the base.
Yeah.
Yeah, it had a wheel that you could snap a joystick onto. So the joystick would move the wheel around, which in turn operated whatever, you know, sent the commands to the game system. And then you had a number pad, but you had little overlays you would slide into the number pad depending upon what game you were playing so that it would tell you, you know, which number corresponds to what command.
Yeah, I remember Intellivision was, for me, the rich kid game because they were the only ones whose parents would let them get a new one.
Yeah.
Everyone else's parents were like, you've got the Atari.
I think
you're not going to get a different game now.
I inherited an Intellivision from my, cousin sometime around like the late 80s. So well after there was nothing else coming out for it, right? That game system had been dead.
Yeah, sure.
So the things I had, and it was funny because, the collection of games I had and the collection of overlays I had, it was kind of like a Venn diagram with about 40% coverage.
Yeah.
And then like there was overlap of 40%. And then for everything else, I either had an overlay for a game that sounded awesome, but I didn't have it.
Right.
Or a game where I'm like, I have no idea what these buttons are supposed to do.
That's funny.
But at any rate, getting back to Atari, 1982 was also when some things happened that would end up hurting the company in the near future. One is that they rushed a home video game port of a smash hit in the arcades, Pac-Man.
Can I do my impression now?
Please do.
Da-donk, gonk, 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 gonk.
It hurts.
It really sounded about that bad.
Yeah.
It didn't look like Pac-Man. It didn't sound like Pac-Man.
It barely played like Pac-Man. Yep. I mean, you had a maze, and you ate dashes instead of dots, and ghosts would chase after you. They wouldn't turn blue if you ate a power pellet. They would just start flashing.
Yeah.
And
it didn't sound like it. The colors weren't even the same.
The controller was terrible.
Yeah, they botched it on almost every single level. But yeah. I was one of those kids who bought it on Christmas Day that year because it was the most exciting thing to come out.
Well, Pac-Man was groundbreaking in the arcades. Fever. Like, yeah, we had a whole song about it.
It was legit.
And it was a dance and everything.
Yeah.
The worst thing to me is that they could have done it right because later on, Atari 2600 released a Ms. Pac-Man, which actually wasn't bad.
Yeah, that's one of the better games, actually.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy that Ms. Pac-Man was, you know, it just showed that they could have done it better, but they rushed it through, and that ended up being a big downside. Now, it sold well. I think they produced 12 million copies, and they sold 7 million of them or something.
Yeah, at the time, there were 10 million 2600 units, and they said every single person is going to buy one. And then 2 million more people will go out and buy a 2600 to play Pac-Man.
Right.
That is some hubris,
my friend. And then when
it backfired in a big way.
Word comes around that the game's not so good, people started to put the brakes on that. But they also, in 1982, released Yar's Revenge. That was the one that
That was a good game, though.
Yeah, it was a good game. And it took Ray Kassar's name and reversed the first three. Reversed Ray to Yar.
Yeah, they eventually would ship, I remember, the 2600 with Pac-Man instead of combat. That's how low it fell.
Right. I'm glad I got
it. Was the free
I'm glad
game.
I got mine in the combat days.
Yeah, me too.
So the game Yar's Revenge was developed by a guy named Howard Scott Warshaw, who also developed two other games that are notable. One is one we talked about before. The Indiana Jones Raiders of the Lost Ark game was developed by him.
Which was fun, but totally confounding.
Yeah.
It was a hard game to play.
It was. I was talking to Chuck before we recorded. In fact, I was talking to you earlier this week about how I played that game a lot, and I remember being stuck on the first couple of screens for a really, like a snake would come out of behind a rock and bite me and I'd die.
Yeah.
And I'd think, well, I've got this gun, but I'm almost certain this gun's going to be important for something else. So if I shoot the snake, is that a good idea? Should I whip the snake to death?
Well, it was the first game where you used both joysticks to play.
Yeah.
And the first game, I think, where you could pick up multiple things and had like an inventory.
Yeah.
It was just really confusing.
Yeah.
And challenging, but confusing.
Yeah. When I finally watched a playthrough, that was maybe a year ago, I watched a playthrough
of it.
Yeah, I kept thinking, as I was watching, I was like, oh yeah, I got that far. Because I kept forgetting how far I got. I just remembered the frustration of not knowing what was going on.
Yeah.
But I realized later on that I actually played that game, if not to completion, nearly to completion.
I don't know if I ever finished it. Wow, I really stuck
with that game.
Yeah.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Warshaw's probably most famous.
Oh, poor guy.
For a game that is often talked about as being the worst video game ever made. In fact, Tech Stuff, we did an episode about the worst games ever made, and this was number one on our list.
Oh, really?
Because it was voted on by the listeners.
Yeah.
E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
Yeah, I saw a list that did not even list it in the top 10 worst.
Yeah.
Because they're saying it gets unnecessarily ribbed.
Yeah.
Even though it is bad, people don't know about the worst of the worst games that were produced by these third-party companies.
E.T. was produced by Atari,
yeah.
Right? This was not one of those little third-party...
The worst Atari game, for sure.
I could tell you what the worst... what I think, at least from a concept point of view, what the worst game that was made for the Atari...
Kool-Aid?
No. Custer's Revenge.
Oh, I don't think I knew that one.
You need to look that up later. And for all my listeners who are... furiously looking up Custer's Revenge Atari 2600. I'm sorry.
Terrible.
It is a racist, misogynistic game that uses awful graphics to depict violating Indian ladies.
Oh my God.
Yeah, no, there was a third party that made and because Atari didn't have a process to approve or deny games on its system, people could make stuff like that.
Sure. Or companies, like I said, Kool-Aid could say, hey, let's make a game that's sort of a TV commercial.
Yeah, exactly. We can make a commercial that's interactive and convince people to buy our stuff more.
Yeah.
And we can even make it so that the only way you can get this game is by buying our stuff and sending proof of purchase in to get the game.
Just to play a crappy game.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, E.T. was a huge setback for the company. They had spent an enormous amount of money to get the license, like between $20 and $25 million.
Yeah, for Spielberg to give that up was a big deal.
Yeah, they produced 4 million copies of the game, and about 3.5 million were returned to Atari, either unsold or people had returned their copy to the game store.
Yeah, and the legend, and I should say, I've never, ever played it.
Yeah. Oh, I
don't know why it got by me, because I was so into all that and I loved E.T. I don't know. Maybe I heard it was crappy and I just don't remember, but I never played it. But then the story gets kind of interesting because for many, many years, there was what was thought to be an urban legend that Atari took those and other games and buried them in a landfill in New Mexico and covered it with concrete.
Right.
And for many years, that was like, no, that's just an urban legend.
Right.
But wasn't it last year that they finally dug them up?
It was actually April 2014.
And it was true?
Yeah. They found, in fact, part of the legend at one point was saying, all right, yes, they did it, but first they crushed all the games. So all they're going to end up finding is black plastic and pieces of circuitry.
Not true, though.
No, they found full intact cartridges. Whether or not they still play is another question.
Well,
they sold some of them.
Yeah, and the truest irony, those things were fetching some good money on eBay.
Man, it makes me wish I had held on to my copy and just put a little dirt on it and then
said,
straight from New Mexico, it may still play. Granted, psychological scars never heal, but the money would have helped, right?
Yeah.
So
that was not the death knell for Atari,
no,
as some people like to say, but I saw one writer put it, it may have been the final straw.
Yeah, I think it's a great thing to point at as a symbol of the issues that came about with the video game crash. But that's way more complex. Also, this is 1982 we're talking about. The video game crash happened in 83. So
yeah, there's two big flops, though, with Pac-Man and E.T.
Yeah.
And a lot of money, you know. If Atari hadn't squandered money elsewhere, they could have survived the financial impact of both of these flops.
Right.
So they didn't themselves kill it off.
On top of that, we have the added problem that Atari was trying to push a new system onto the market, the Atari 5200 Super System, coming out in 1982. It was based off the 400/800 line of Atari computers. The controllers had a joystick and a number pad. They were big and hard to use, and they broke pretty easily. But the joystick was interesting. Like, the old Atari joysticks were 8-point analog joysticks, which meant that it could only detect if the joystick was pressing down on any of those 8 points.
Right.
This one was a 360-degree analog joystick, giving you much more precise control, but it was also non-centering. There was no spring to have it move back to the center.
Yeah, they had a lot of problems with the joystick.
Yeah.
And apparently Atari had so many problems with the joystick, while the game was released, they tried and reshipped, like, I don't know how many versions of the joystick,
right.
6 or 8 different versions.
Yeah. Well, and on top of that, it couldn't play 2600 games. So
that was a really big deal.
Yeah, if you had your library of games, I mean, anyone who plays video games knows about issues with backwards compatibility.
Yeah.
We love it when a system is backwards compatible with earlier systems, and we hate it when it's not, because you spend all this money accruing a library of games, and you don't, you know, you only have so many options to hook things up to your TV. You don't want to negate all that. So another blow against it was that the 5200 games, in large part, were just updates of 2600 games.
Yeah.
So then you have to buy the same game twice. You have to buy a new, which people who have the Xbox One are probably laughing right now, because that's what's happening over there.
Oh, really?
Also the PS4. Yeah, several of the games that have come out for the PS4 and the Xbox One over the last year or so have been remasters of games that came out for the previous systems, like Grand Theft Auto 5 is coming out this year for the Xbox One.
Are they not any better?
Well, they're higher quality graphics.
Okay.
Sometimes there's also some added gameplay elements, so it's not the exact same game. It is an enhancement, but it does mean that if you had an Xbox 360 and a copy of Grand Theft Auto 5, now are you going to go and purchase a Grand Theft Auto 5 for your Xbox One?
Because
even with the enhancements, there's something in your brain that's saying, you bought this once already.
Right.
You know?
Sure.
Like, you know, yeah, I might have more stuff in it, but you still did buy it already. This was also the year when Pitfall came out. So insult to injury for Atari, because they're having all these issues. And meanwhile, Activision puts out Pitfall. Also, Jay Miner, who designed the Atari 800 chipset, left Atari to design a new computer called the Amiga, which was based off a similar chipset idea. And that was originally going to be a video game console, but was reimagined as a general purpose computer, because now we're in 1983, the video game market comes crashing down.
Yeah.
Especially the home video game market, specifically the home video game market. And TechStuff did a full episode on the great video game crash. We're still going to talk about it some, because obviously it was monumentally important in the history of Atari. Part of the issue was that you had this enormous number of crappy games coming from all these third-party companies. Plus, Atari had already made some really bad first-party games, like the Pac-Man conversion and the E.T. game. So,
well, not only that, not just the games, but there were there was console overload as well. There were, I mean, if you look at the list of the console games that came out that were just barely even made a register in the market,
right?
It was just. It was flooded with, you know, it was just a glut of bad games, bad consoles.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, we talked about the Intellivision, the ColecoVision, and the Atari 2600 and 5200. There were lots of other consoles that had hit the market because everyone saw this as a way to make huge amounts of money. I mean, Atari had proven that this was a multi-million dollar industry, and everyone wanted a piece of that. But the problem was now you had a glut of consoles and games. It was, there was confusion in the marketplace. I mean, imagine, Chuck, for a moment, your parents going to the toy store.
Oh, sure.
And thinking, this is the game he wants. And it says Intellivision across the top, not Atari.
Yeah.
And they buy it, not knowing that this was for a totally different game console system. I mean, it was, and not only that, we had all these elements. You also had the burgeoning personal computer market.
Yeah, that's the thing. It wasn't like the home tech was bottoming out.
Right.
Computers were more popular than ever, and they started to market, hey, you can play games and do home computing on these things.
Yeah.
So why just get this console that just plays games?
Right. You could
like,
get this
is going to be the thing of the past.
Exactly. You could get this thing that lets your kids waste hours and hours staring at the TV as they move a little dot around, or you could get our thing, which lets them play games if they want to, but it also lets them do their homework.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can do your taxes and all this kind of stuff. And I mean, it was a very compelling argument. So this combination of events caused the market to just bottom out. You had stories of games discounting stores like toy stores discounting games, putting them in bargain bins where you get like, you know, a dollar or $2 to pick up these cartridges.
I was buying them up too, man.
Yeah, so was I. Quality was not an issue. I was like, I want quantity.
Yeah, me too. Because if the game stunk, you paid $2 for it. You just didn't play it that much.
You're like, all right, well, you know, that was, I mowed the lawn for that.
But yeah.
the lawn will regrow and
that's
I will
right.
mow it again. Also Atari made another dumb mistake, which I can't completely blame them for. All right. So there were some issues that happened. The video game crash, the ET plan, the Pac-Man plan. There was also supposedly some questionable stock dealings that led Atari to the board of directors to fire the CEO, Ray Kassar.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know if Kassar was, he had not made the best moves for that company anyway.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like Bushnell leaving.
No.
But it definitely made the company unstable.
Yeah, so he was pushed out. A guy named James J. Morgan would take over as CEO. But here was something else that was going on behind the scenes at Atari that could have totally helped the company coast through the video game crash and rise to new heights. There was a company in Japan. Company that started out selling playing cards.
Yeah.
That's how it started. It made a game console in Japan, referred to as the Famicom. We know it as the Nintendo Entertainment System. And in 1983, Nintendo and Atari were in talks for Atari to be the United States distributor of the Famicom Entertainment System.
Yeah, they said, we'll keep Japan.
Yeah.
Atari's big over there. You guys do a great job. Let's partner up.
Yeah, you can put your branding on it.
Yep.
We'll have it all planned out. It'll be a partnership. And Nintendo was moving forward with it, or Atari and Nintendo were moving forward with this. But there were a couple of things that caused some hiccups. One of them was that Coleco was shipping the ColecoVision with Donkey Kong. Donkey Kong is a Nintendo game. And under this agreement, this partnership agreement, Atari was supposed to get exclusive rights to Nintendo games.
Right.
And so the fact that a Nintendo game was appearing on a Coleco product caused this deal to slow down. Meanwhile, Kassar, who was kind of the moving force of this deal, this could have been his redemption.
Oh, yeah.
He's fired. Now there's no one at the ship who was actually in charge of this deal. And
yeah, that made
fizzles.
Nintendo really nervous.
Yeah. And there's no one for them to talk to anymore.
Yeah.
So they said, you know what? We're going to try this ourselves. We're going to work on this, and in a couple of years, we're going to launch in the United States under our own brand name. And that's what they did. But with just a couple of changes in history, Atari could have been
Nintendo.
Nintendo.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. It could have been the Atari Entertainment System.
Yeah.
And by the way, the reason it's called the entertainment system is because by that point, Nintendo had seen the video game market crashed, and there was now this kind of stigma against video games. So they said, let's call it an entertainment system. We won't call it a video game system, and we'll make it look very, you know, boxy. And,
yeah, like your VCR.
Yeah.
And it'll sit on the shelf, and your parents won't mind it. It won't look like some crazy game.
Right. And very savvy move.
Yeah.
As it turns out, Nintendo made all the right decisions there. So really rough times for Atari. And this is also when the arcade branch of Atari released the licensed first-person space simulator game that's my favorite arcade game of all time. Chuck, what do you think it is?
Oh, gee, I don't know.
It's a first-person game.
First-person?
It's a space setting. Vector graphics. Voices from a movie.
Oh, licensed. Star Wars.
Yes!
Yeah,
my
course.
Favorite arcade game of
really?
All time. Star Wars.
Yeah, you know, I didn't, oddly enough, I didn't play that much.
If I found an arcade that had the cockpit version.
Oh, well, yeah.
Where you sat down and you held onto that yoke.
Yeah.
And the music would come up. And,
sure.
You know, keep in mind, guys, this is not like orchestra level music, but it sounded good at the time.
Yeah, it was chiptunes.
And it actually had the voices of the actors in there too. You would hear Obi-Wan say, "The Force will be with you always."
Right in your head.
I loved this game without reservation. My favorite game of all time. If I could actually find a version of this,
I would buy it for you.
Yeah, the hardest thing would be talking to my wife and saying, you know, where are we going to put this in the limited space in our house? I know it would have to go in my office. I just don't know how I would make room in there.
You'd make room.
I would make room. I couldn't get the cockpit version. That would be way too big. I'd have to get the stand-up version. But hey, if you've got a stand-up cabinet version of Star Wars you're looking to unload and it works, let me know. Or let Chuck know because he's going to buy it for me. Also, two other games would get Atari to release them in Europe, not in the United States. The United States had a different distributor.
Yeah.
But there were two other games that were really important in the history of video games, Dragon's Lair and Space Ace.
Yeah, Dragon's Lair, I remember, was that was the first game that used
Laserdisc.
Yeah, it was the graphics.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't.
It was animated.
It's almost like a cartoon.
Yeah, Don Bluth did all the animation. He was a Disney animator for a long time, worked on Oliver and Company and a couple of other movies. Also did the Fievel movies, like American Tail, those.
Yeah, the gameplay I remember wasn't great though.
No.
Because you couldn't really control live. Didn't you make moves and then it would play it out?
Yeah,
the way
it would work is there would be a moment where you had to put in a command, whether it was left, right, up, down, or sword swing, whatever. And if you didn't do it at the exact time with the right move, you died. And if you did, you would progress to the next scene, and it would essentially play out like a cartoon.
Yeah, I remember now. I remember thinking, man, that looks amazing.
Yeah.
Let me put my quarter in, and then saying, this sucks, I'm going to play Galaga.
Right. Well, you'd put your four quarters in, right?
Because
that was
one
of the really expensive ones. It was either, I think it actually might have been the first game to go 50 cents.
Well, it was tokens, though, at the time.
Yeah, there you
because
go.
Because I remember you would go on Tuesdays to Battlezone, and you would get, like, 20 tokens for a dollar.
I remember, what was
like
it?
The good deal going.
What was the one, the Gold Nugget, something like that. There was one that
I went to.
I think it was in Gwinnett, actually.
Oh, okay.
Because
Northlake Mall had the Gold Mine.
Gold Mine. That's it. Gold Mine.
That was one of the great mall arcades.
Yeah.
In Atlanta in the
1980s.
Fantastic.
Well, you know what?
This is going to be a three-parter.
It's going to be a three-parter. We talked about the possibility of it being a three-parter at
and
the beginning. We are now 55 minutes in. And we still have the rest of Atari. We've just hit 1983. But here's the good news, folks. From 1984 to the present day, a lot of stuff happens, but we don't have a whole lot to say about each individual part.
Yeah.
We just have to explain what goes on from a corporate level. But I think we can clearly say that the video game crash, if you don't consider Bushnell selling Atari to Warner as being its first death, this has got to be the first death because the company was absolutely devastated by this. The arcade business was still going fairly well, but the home video game market completely bottomed out. So when we pick up, we'll pick up in 1984 when another dramatic moment, another death of Atari happens immediately. And then we'll just have the sad tale of sinking lower and lower from that point forward. So for those of you out there who want to know how some other technological thing works, that's not Atari and you're looking forward to hearing about it, you need to let me know first. Send me an email. My address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com. Drop me a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Tumblr. The handle at all three is techstuff, HSW. You can find Mr. Chuck Bryant with Stuff You Should Know.
That's right.
And you should, because it's an awesome show.
Thank you.
You are welcome. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.